Man, did they fire everybody funny at The Onion or what? Those guys used to be so good. I actually think I read a thing like that where all the funny people left to go fail at trying to compete with something with a brand name like Onion. But boy, a lot of those are not funny. Well, let's see. Here's the premise. Young people write funny stuff on their Facebook page that goes on their permanent record, and so... Maybe we could do a whole skit about how it's going to make it hard for them to go to Congress in 15 years or whatever. Hilarious. They used to employ some funny people there anyway. I don't know. They had a whole, like, kind of Sunday morning news show panel discussion about the CIA's Facebook project. Putting everybody in the world in a position to just give them all the data they could have never collected without us helping. Blah, blah. Anyway. Well, whatever. I'm Scott Horton, and Our Dumb Century was still a great book. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, tonight on Liberty Chat. I have no idea. And I sure better not forget to do the dang show. I didn't even show up and do Liberty Chat last week. I was supposed to do Liberty Chat at 8 o'clock Eastern Time and libertychat.com, and I just didn't show up because I didn't think about it a single time all day until, I think, Thursday when Tom Woods interviewed me. And then I says, oh, yeah, I was supposed to do the Liberty Chat 2 days ago, wasn't I? Man, I have to tattoo that on the back of my hand or something. Anyway, I have no idea who's going to be on the show, but it'll either be about Iraq or it'll be about something libertarian or something. I don't know. I'm going to have to work on that. I have a couple hours of business hours after the show today, Eastern Time, to still mess around and see if I can get somebody lined up. So it should be fine. That'll be at libertychat.com at 8 Eastern. Listen to me interview someone, or maybe two someones, about something. And by the way, the last Liberty Chat I did 2 weeks ago featured really great interviews with Doug Bandow and Todd Pierce. And then they got lost to history, but I'm working on that. You might have to go back through the archives a little bit to find them. It was just 2 weeks ago. Anyway. So I'm Scott. David Stockman is going to be on the show today, author of The Great Deformation and former Reaganite and pretty hardcore libertarian piece in it, it seems like to me. And he wrote the greatest thing that anybody ever wrote, which is, you know, surprising that I would be able to get the phone number of a guy who wrote the greatest thing that anybody ever wrote. But I'm pretty sure this is it. Keynesian Myths, Monetary Central Planning, and the Triumph of the Warfare State. And this is part 6 of something else he said. Holy crap. I didn't realize. Well, I mean, the real occasion for me having him on the show will be the anniversary, the 100-year centennial type of thingamajig going on here with the Great War. The war that started all wars. Doug Bandow has a great write-up on World War I that I guess ran on antiwar.com yesterday. You can find it at Forbes. Doug's brilliant. He wrote a great thing about it. Margulies has got a great thing. We ran at antiwar.com. Jim Powell, of course, is a favorite of mine, wrote the book Wilson's War, and there's a good article by him. It's old, but still, what we can learn from Woodrow Wilson's great blunder at lourockwell.com. And anyway, as I've tried to make the case before, you can actually see me give, there are two different speeches that I gave that this guy combines them into one, and then plus it's 1,000 times better than what I did. But if you look at my YouTube channel, you can see me give a speech about how everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault for intervening in World War I. And man, holy crap, what was it? Was it this? No, it was something else. Oh, it was Bandow. Bandow has the quote of freaking Churchill. Where is this? I gotta find this. Yeah, here it is. World War I Still Rages is the title at antiwar.com today, right now, okay? And man, I got to find the Churchill quote here. This pissed me off, man, because, you know, I kind of think he helped lie America into war in World War I. Guess I'd have to go back and read my Colin Simpson to get my facts straight on that. But yeah, anyway, where's the damn quote? Give me the quote. I'm paging down. Churchill in 1936. Quote, America should have minded its own business and stayed out of the World War. This is before the second one. This is when it was just the World War. America should have minded its own business and stayed out of the World War. If you hadn't entered the war, the Allies would have made peace with Germany in the spring of 1917. Had we made peace, there would have been no collapse in Russia followed by communism, no breakdown in Italy followed by fascism, and Germany would not have signed the Versailles Treaty, which has enthroned Nazism in Germany. Whoa! The Versailles Treaty, which has enthroned Nazism. Which, of course, everybody knows that. But that is stated as plainly as anyone else has ever stated it, and it's the most quotable guy since Jesus or John Lennon or whatever, Mao, Vladimir Lennon, John Lennon, you pick which Lennon is more quotable out of those two. But Winston Churchill, the Versailles Treaty enthroned Nazism in Germany. So no World War II, no American Empire, no Cold War, no coup in Iran, no support for Saddam, no support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. No terror war. And yes, the British would still be butchering people to death by the millions around the world, but at least it wouldn't be our fault like it is now. Well, our, you know, very, very, very loosely defined there. But you know what I mean. So there you go. That's, boy, I wish I had known that quote when I gave my speech. I would have ended it with, see, here's Churchill even admitting that I'm right about everything. Everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. And then the other thing is, one of the things that's his fault is the central bank. And as Stockman points out in this other article and in the one I was just mentioning, Keynesian Myths is the first one, Sarajevo is the fulcrum of modern history. The Great War and its terrible aftermath is the other. And anyway, he does such a great job of showing about central banking and war and how the Federal Reserve made the American role in World War I possible. And then, in fact, how the Great Depression was the consequence of America's continued bailouts of the British, which, you know, Robert Higgs explains that in Depression War and Cold War as well, that was the real stock market bubble, not just of the whole roaring 20s where prices should have been falling but stayed the same. But why did prices get propped way up in the stock market? And why? Because it was all free money that the U.S. government, well, the Federal Reserve Bank, was creating in order to bail out the British pound. And that was the bubble that popped and led to the Great Depression. And you know what? I'm actually really glad I don't have anybody on at 1:30 at this point. I really need Jason at 1:30 if possible. Let's see. I really need him at 1:30 if possible. Yeah. Anyway, I'd like to keep this guy over time because we're only going to have 20 minutes to 10-minute segments, and that ain't right. I really want to talk with Stockman about a lot of this stuff, man. You see, the empire and the boom and the bust, the central bank and the permanent war, it's all wrapped up together. And by the way, if you're a liberal or a progressive or a leftist or any kind of conservative or anything else, you don't have to agree with libertarians about what we think about anything necessarily. But you got to admit the Austrians are right about what causes the boom and the bust in the economy. It's the government's inflation of the money supply, mostly to pay for their wars, to make them seem free at first. Anyway, Stockman and then Gareth Porter, Gene Healy. Great show today. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, yeah. Eh, sorry I wasted that whole segment just talking about who's going to be on the show today. Stockman is going to be on to talk about World War One. I'm going to give him 20 minutes to talk about World War One, Woodrow Wilson, the central bank, the boom and the bust cycle, and 100 years of American empire. You think he can do it? I'm going to tell him, pare it down, man. Get right to the point, dude. How many wars? How much inflation? How's this work again? Thank you. It's just the format of the show. We'll do what we can. And I'll try to keep him over time. If I can't get Jason Ditz to fill that slot, which I really need Jason or somebody to fill that slot, I'm going to be trying to fill that slot with somebody all day today. But otherwise, I'll try to keep him over time. But anyway. Gareth is going to be on to talk about strong-arming the Iranians on their nuclear program. And Gene Healy is going to be on. Haven't spoken with Gene Healy since 2004. And I have no idea what I asked him about back then. But anyway, he wrote a great book called The Imperial Presidency, which is important. He's a Cato guy, one of the top guys at Cato. And he's written a thing about the first Gulf War. Oh, which reminds me, I need to cue up my clip of George H.W. Bush saying, "This will not be another Vietnam," you know, 23 years ago. Let's see, Bush. Found my Bush section. Here's him encouraging the Shia to rise up in 1991. This doesn't seem to be in here. Oh. Anyway, I do have the babies in incubators clip. Gene Healy's going to be on to talk about how George H.W. Bush got us into this mess. Back when the good Gulf War, as it's been sold. And anyway, now, so this is funny, dude. Yesterday, you guys heard me arguing with Phil Giraldi. Phil Giraldi, the former CIA counterterrorism expert, is saying, "Chill, man. The terrorist threat from ISIS is not that big of a deal." And I'm going, "Nuh-uh, man. I'm afraid." And he's saying, no, relax. And I'm going, "Nah, I'm paranoid as can be." And the truth is, I don't think that the daylight is very far on this issue, and I ought to just go ahead and chill out and defer to him. I sound like I'm strung out on crank or something. Not that I am. But I'm paranoid because I can't help but thinking that it makes sense from a strategic point of view for the Islamic State to carry out the same agenda of attacks against the far enemy, the West. Because look at how successful that strategy has been at bankrupting us, demoralizing us, and I mean us as in the American people, our society, completely discrediting the United States and discrediting any of our sock puppets in the Middle East who would go along with us and radicalizing, you know, a generation of at least thousands, which how many do you need? Also help destroy the economies of all those countries and destabilize them and lead to the Arab Spring in all of its incarnations. It makes perfect sense. The strategic logic of suicide terrorism prevails. And it wouldn't take 20 guys to get away with a 9/11 to bait the United States into intervening here. What's most important, and I guess I have no faith at all in the cops of Western Europe or America, or the spies of Western Europe or America, to have identified all the guys with Western passports who may well get assigned to come on missions here. And that was what was so special about the 9/11 hijackers, is they were studying in Germany. They could get into the United States. And, well, the pilots anyway, and of course then there was the whole Saudi visa waiver thing going on there. Not sure exactly who all arranged that. But anyway, that's the thing of it. It just seems, one, like it makes sense for them to try it, and two, like it'd be easy for them to do. And so, you know, I don't know. That's pretty scary. Or, I don't know, scary, but it sounds like the kind of thing that could be a problem. Giraldi and me are both concluding the same thing, however, which is that, so don't intervene. Don't bomb them. Don't help Iran. Don't help Syria. Don't help nobody. Just stay out of it. The way, in fact, this is so funny. I know he wrote this right after I talked to him. He wrote, talk show rhetoric doesn't equal good intelligence on the domestic danger posed by Iraq's terrorists. Well, good. I am so happy that I helped to inspire a everyone calm down and don't believe the war propaganda article out of a former CIA terrorism expert. Perfect. I like that, Giraldi. He's always telling people, calm down. Don't bomb anything. He says that like every day. He says, stop bombing stuff. Okay, I'm listening. That was what he told me the first time I ever interviewed Phil Giraldi in 2005. I said, so what do we do about this whole war on terror? He said, ramp this whole thing down. First and foremost, quit making more enemies. Watch their support dry up. Go about your business. That's good advice. I'm absolutely 100% pro that. And but like I was telling him yesterday, I'm looking at Obama, who is intervening all over the place. He's helping the rebels in Syria, but he's still going to send, he's already sending in drones, according to the New York Times, armed drones. He sent now 800 soldiers. Didn't he say 300? 800 soldiers now have gone, and some Marines, that includes some Marines, special forces and force protection for the embassy, and et cetera, like that. And so it's just enough. Let's say that 3 days ago, or 2 weeks ago, when, you know, they sacked Mosul and Tikrit and whatever, that America just said, you know what, we don't even care about Iraq anymore. You guys do your worst. Well, I don't know. If they were leaving us alone, seems like Obama's now provoking them. And, you know, here's the other thing I was thinking. From the point of view of the ISIS guys, they got to understand American politics somewhat. That after what happened already, that the American politicians, you know, that the pressure is on them from the American people, that they could not, barring some horrible unforeseen catastrophe or foreseen, they cannot send in the whole Marine Corps to really take the fight to these guys, which was only counterproductive in the first place. Don't get me wrong. I'm not selling any myth of a surge here or anything. But they couldn't even really do that. But what they could do is send in drones, which are enough to radicalize the hell out of everyone and turn all kinds of enemies against us, but without actually being effective at all in killing those who threaten the United States. Anyway, Giraldi's at the American Conservative. He says, chill out, Scott Horton. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, David Stockman, Gareth Porter, Gene Healy, and probably Jason Ditz. I can't promise. But I sure hope so. All right, so, yeah. There's so much news to cover. I think I need to quit with my talking and thinking out loud and get to the dang news here, man. All right, well, there's my Stockman section. Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. U.S. sending 300 more combat troops to Iraq. No combat troops pledge didn't last long. Boy, like I didn't tell you that 5 years ago. And so he does the math here. CNN's reporting, in addition to the 200 combat troops reported to Congress, another 100 troops who were in the area are moving into Iraq. I guess that means Kuwait or something. These troops are in addition to the 300 troops already guarding the embassy and 300 advisors announced last week. Only 180 of the advisors are here so far, so about 800 U.S. troops are in Iraq now, with expectations of further increases going forward, including support staff for the new combat forces and for the joint operations post in Baghdad, which is what the advisors are there running. So, there you go. 300 becomes 1,000 men in the blink of an eye. Man, all right. Iraqi officials, mortars hit near Samarra Shrine, wounding several. And, well, Maliki, of course, this is also the big news. Where's my, oh, here it is. New Iraqi parliament ends session without progress. They showed up, they did some kind of quorum call, then they took a break, and then the Kurds and the Sunnis left and did not come back. So they lost their quorum, and so the parliament dissolved. So apparently, at least for now, the Sunnis and the Kurds are not going to even participate in the parliament at all unless they have a deal for the removal of Nouri al-Maliki. And, you know, apparently Ayatollah al-Sistani, Ali al-Sistani, agrees about that, which I would think that that would mean that's the end of you, Nouri al-Maliki. Who the hell is defying the wishes of the highest supreme Ayatollah in the world, in the Shiite system? And, you know, it's not exactly a highest rank, because Khamenei has political powers, a head of state in Iran, and Sistani is not a supreme leader in that sense, but he is officially the highest ranking religious leader. Anyway, usually what he says goes. I don't know. I mean, Maliki's got an army, though. Now, how many troops does the Pope have? Turns out quite a lot. So, can Sistani turn Maliki out if push comes to shove? Yes, has to be. Right? Anyway, that's where they stand in the parliament right now. They're getting nowhere whatsoever. Maliki is sticking with his position. And now, so there are reports. I can't believe this, but I guess I can believe this. There are reports that Ahmed Chalabi is in contention, which, of course, I've been trying to tell you. He was Iran's guy all along. That's what Mitchell Prothero said on the show the other day. Well, of course, he's Iran's guy. He's on the short list. And next to him is Abdulmahdi, Al-Mahdi, I think it is, who, he's from the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, the Badr Brigade, the Hakim family. He's the guy who was vice president before, and the reason that they had picked Jafari and Maliki from the Dawa Party is because they were the compromise between the Sadrists and the Supreme Islamic Council. The Sadrists being the Iraqi Shiite Arab nationalists who wanted a coalition with the Sunnis, and the Supreme Islamic Council being the former expats buzzed in by Iran and America, really, who wanted strong federalism and alliance with Iran. Now, the Mahdi army and the Hakim family, the Supreme Islamic Council, they have their, or Sadr and Hakim have their own armies, the Mahdi army and the Badr Brigade. So they had compromised and settled on the two Dawah party guys, first Jafari, then Maliki, because they didn't have their own army. So at least that would be, you know, you can see how they're splitting the difference there, basically. So anyway, if Al-Mahdi comes in, he's representing the faction most determined to work with Iran in splitting off all the land from Baghdad to Basra and let Mosul and the Sunni areas go to hell. It's too much trouble than it's worth. At least that would be their long-term goal. Seemingly, it has been their long-term goal all along, the Supreme Islamic Council. So you got Chalabi or Abdul-Mahdi. On the other hand, I read very briefly, I scanned through this thing this morning. I did not have time to look at it, but it was the Going to Tehran blog of Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett. And it was sort of a Tom Dispatch introduction style thing to somebody else's essay, which I didn't even get to. But anyway, the point being that they mentioned in there that the Russians and the Saudis are talking and they want Iyad Alawi to come back. Iyad Alawi, you might remember, used to work for Saddam Hussein. Then he went to work for the CIA and then America invaded. And after the first year, he was the first sock puppet dictator of the country after Paul Bremer. Remember the official handover of power in right this time, 2004, 10 years ago. And then he was in that position for almost 2 years until, wait a minute. No, he was just in that position for almost a year until the elections of 2005 brought together or brought to power the United Iraqi Alliance, which again was the Supreme Islamic Council, the Dawah Party, and the Sadrists. And so Alawi has been on the out since then. But here's the thing about Alawi is, and you can see why the Saudis prefer him, because he's a Shiite Ba'athist. And he goes, like I was just saying, he goes back to, he used to work for Saddam. And I think was a pretty high-level head of intelligence type guy, this, that, the other thing. And in fact, well, anyway, it's probably way too late. I don't know, man. What the hell do I know? But it seems to me like it's way too late for there to be any kind of real reconciliation between the Sunnis and the Shia political factions at this point. I mean, you know, I don't know. They gotta all be sick and tired of killing and dying, too. You know, that gets exhausting after all this, what America has put them through over there. So there gotta be some who were wanting to compromise. But if the Sunni factions are so desperate that they're turning to ISIS, then that means, of course, like we were talking about yesterday with Landay, that means that the Iraqi army is going to have to turn. They already are turning to the Badr Brigade. And we'll see soon the Mahdi army as well to help them at least, you know, protect Baghdad and the Shiite areas. They're not the Iraqi army is not going to be effective without the partisan Shiite militias. So that just makes it that much harder in fighting ISIS to see any kind of compromise between, you know, for example, the former Awakening Councils or anything like that. And by the way, though, speaking of which, there is this article in The Telegraph with an interview with a guy named Soleimani, who is a Sunni tribal sheikh who is not a bin Ladenite at all, but who has allied with ISIS and says that he will remain allied with ISIS until Maliki steps down. And then at that point, he says he's willing to turn on them, which that dude better look out because, well, I don't know how untouchable he is. Apparently, he's got thousands of people under him. Real big mob boss there in the Sunni areas, supposedly. And he's outright saying, don't worry, I'll take care of ISIS when the time comes. But that time hadn't come yet, not till Maliki's out. And so I guess that's a pretty hard way of saying that maybe there could be a future of compromise. That would mean an end to the Islamic State, it sounds like, necessarily, and the recreation of Iraq. But boy, they were supposed to work this out in 07 and never did. More the international reaction and the spread of ISIS on the other side of this break than David Stockman. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. Later on the show, we're going to talk a little bit about Iraq War history. We're going to go back to 1990, 91 with Gene Healy and Bush Sr. getting us into this mess in the first place. And really, you know, Reagan before him and Carter before him. Robert Perry published the document from Al Haig, General Haig, come back from visiting the King of Saudi Arabia. Said, yeah, he told me all about how Jimmy Carter had instructed him to tell Saddam Hussein to please do go ahead and invade Iran in 1980. Anyway, so, you know, and in fact, there's a great article we ran on antiwar.com yesterday by a guy named Brill. Michael Brill. At More Viewpoints, you can find it. I really should have this guy on to talk about this. Where the hell is it? It's Michael Patrick Brill, and he's written two for us now at antiwar.com. Iraq Maliki's Assad Moment, which that's his... did we not run that one yet? Okay, that's the only one that's run so far. Sorry. There's another one where he goes all into the history that I guess is going to run soon here. But anyway, America's been messing around with Saddam and the Baathists and the Iraqis since the end of the second... Well, not Saddam, but messing with the Iraqis since the end of the Second World War and messing around with Saddam since at least the late 50s and helping him kill his opposition and everything else and that. Anyway, we're going to talk with Gene Healy about the first Gulf War. It's really important you get the backstory on this. I've noticed, as I'm sure you've noticed, a lot of talk about how bad American soldiers must feel that all their work was for nothing over there when, of course, they're the ones who made it this way, not deliberately, but by following their officers' orders. They're the ones who made it this way. And I know not deliberately because I used to get emails from these guys all the time. We're fighting for the freedom of the people here. And I would say, no, you are fighting for the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq against the Sunni tribes of the Anbar province. And and they would write back, huh, I guess I didn't really know about any of that. I was just talking about a slogan, but you're a traitor, blah, 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 terrorism. They're the ones who made it this way. And you know what they did making it this way? They got 1 million people killed. And I'm sorry because it sounds like a singular term. Would it be better if I said 900,000 people killed? That sounds like more almost. Whichever way makes it sound like as many as it actually is. 1 million individual human beings dead in that war. And that's the excess deaths. That's not exactly killed in the war. That's at least hundreds of thousands killed violently in the war, which rages to this day. But America has really, and the reason that they're still fighting this day is because the U.S. completely destroyed their society. They abolished all their, you know, fascist, socialist, government-run industries and replaced them with nothing. That's a war. They abolished, you know, the most basic institutions of society, like electricity, clean water, basic security, for everyone, for a decade straight. They've caused millions of widows to raise children without fathers. They've caused millions of refugees, internal and externally displaced, approximately 4.5 million, four and a half million, about half and half, internally cleansed from one province to another. You know, as that means their family members were tortured to death, and so they fled for their lives in the middle of the night. And many of them made it to Jordan and Assyria. Many of them have come back again, since they're so much worse again now, and et cetera, and on. But, you know, and you know what? I don't mean to play down how bad it sucks for an American, somebody who, as far as I know, is my next door neighbor, somebody who was in third grade with me or something like that, or I don't know, over there, who lost his best friend in the most horribly violent way that most of us could not even imagine, really imagine in a detailed way what it's like to have your best friend blown to pieces next to you. I mean, and they went through all this for what? Because they were lied to by a bunch of liars and a bunch of lemming Americans who went on even after they were proven liars. Okay, where are the warehouses full of sarin and VX that you said you knew were here? They're not here. And then half the population doubled down. Well, I don't care. We're giving them a democracy anyway because that's what TV told me to say. Derp. We can't cut and run now because the violence there will get worse, they said. Are you kidding me? This is America's fault. And millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of Iraqis have had to suffer. Their family members killed in the most brutal manner. Wounds. And just all the loss, you know, the grief, of course, of you know, loved ones suffering. And just imagine the lost opportunity costs for them, and I mean for the individuals there. I don't mean for any greater good, but I just mean the years that children spent not learning. You know, not being raised by adults who could take the time to care for them well because they're too busy trying to not get dead every last moment that they're awake. There's, you know, there's no way for me to possibly be hyperbolic enough to get across to you the truth of the suffering of the Iraqi people at the hands of the American people. Those who love it and cheer for it. Those who refuse to lift a finger to do a thing about it. This whole time. For generations now. Like they're not even human beings at all. There's no way I could overstate it. You read the book Collateral Damage by, yes, it's Chris Hedges, the plagiarist, but don't worry. The book is just edited by him and by Layla Al-Aryan. They wrote, you can find the short version at The Nation if you don't want to go out and get a book and you know you're not going to go out and get it and read the book. You can read it at The Nation. If you search for Hedges and Aryan and Iraq, you'll find, edited by them, the as carefully vetted as possible stories, first-hand accounts of American soldiers and what they had done in Iraq at their commanding officer's will to the people of that country. And it's divided up by house raids, checkpoints, airstrikes, I don't know, torture in prison, whatever. I'm making up the last one there. I don't remember exactly, but that's the way the chapters are divided up, or along those type lines. And it's just the Americans telling stories of killing people. You know, in fact, I just read something the other day where a guy, I think this was something in the Washington Post. I said, let me tell you about my time in Iraq. I did two tours over there. I never saw the enemy once. And then he said, let me be clear about what I'm telling you here. I'm telling you, I never laid my eyes on anyone who was trying to kill me the whole time I was there. And they were trying to kill me. But it was just all snipers and roadside bombs. It was fighting ghosts. I just read somebody telling that same story. Imagine that for post-traumatic stress. Well, there's a story like that comes to mind out of Chris Hedges' book, where finally, somebody jumps up out of a pile of trash with an AK-47 and unloads at this Humvee. And the boys in the Humvee, our boys in the Humvee, this is 2005, America's occupation there, something like that. They turn on this person with the AK, and they absolutely blow the shit out of them. They just kill the crap out of them. Every single person unloads from, you know, the guy with the big gun on top, everybody just shoot. Finally a target to shoot at. After months of this, being terrorized. I mean, yeah, they're the occupiers. I'm not misunderstanding, but I'm putting myself in the position of the average Joe, G.I. Joe, you know, enlistee over there. Enlisted man over there. Playing the IED lottery, that's what they used to call it, over there fighting against invisible men. finally a target. They completely waste him off the face of the earth. They go over there and look, and the body's a 14-year-old boy. It's his land. They're the stormtroopers of the Empire. They're the ones trespassing. He had the right to shoot at them. And they had no right to kill him. And I bet you, wouldn't you bet, that at least one of the boys in the Humvee that killed that kid is no longer with us today at his own hand over that? And how many times did stuff like that happen? Over and over again, that whole war long. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
How can you shoot women, children?
Easy. You just don't need them so much. Ain't war hell?
for crying out loud. Well, everybody, David Stockman's phone is busy. That's no way to conduct an interview with a busy telephone. I mean, I could talk to the busy signal, but that probably wouldn't sound very good to you. Oh, well. Crap. Well, that just about ruins everything. You know what I'll do? I'm going to call Jason Ditz right now. And then I'm going to see if I can bump Stockman till the bottom of the hour. Doesn't that sound like a good idea?
Now that the war is over and there's some difficulty.
This is Charlie Rose from PBS asking the most qualified public intellectual in America. Why America attacked Iraq?
Now that the war is over and there's some difficulty with the peace, was it worth doing?
Well, I think it was unquestionably worth doing, Charlie. And I think that looking back, I now certainly feel I understand more what the war was about. We needed to go over there, basically, and take out a very big stick, right in the heart of that world, and burst that bubble. And there was only one way to do it. And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad, and basically saying, which part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this, okay? That, Charlie, was what this war was about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia. It was part of that bubble. Could have hit Pakistan. We hit Iraq because we could. That's the real truth.
All right. Well, you know what? First of all, I'm sorry that was so loud. Jeez, your poor eardrums. I just wasn't paying attention to my levels during that. Secondly, you notice he picks Baghdad to Basra, where it's not like there are no Sunnis there. But there are certainly no bin Ladenites there. I mean, you're talking about super majority Shiite territory even back then. So he says we could have hit Pakistan where, you know, their government helped back the Taliban that gave safe haven, blah, 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 some kind of connection. The Saudis who financed the whole damn project from 1990 on, whatever. But instead, we decided to pick people who there couldn't possibly be a single person who had the slightest thing to do with any of this. Because, you know, we just had to demonstrate, suck on this. And I'll never get over how whenever he goes, suck on this, Charlie Rose immediately says, okay. God, you guys. Anyway, I got Jason Ditz on the line. He's the news editor at antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com, and he's keeping track of all the bad news in the whole world for us there. Thank God. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us short notice like this and everything. So listen, they found the bodies of the three abducted teenagers from the West Bank, and then all hell broke loose. That's all I know. Could you please fill us in? What's going on over there?
Well, all hell kind of broke loose before they found the bodies. Israel's been launching bizarrely aggressive military operations looking for these teenagers, even though it didn't seem like they had any idea where to look or realistically who took them. Officially, they're blaming Hamas, which, when it was just a kidnapping, was at least plausible because, you know, Hamas has some history of kidnapping people and seeking to trade them for other detainees. Mm-hmm. But now that they found the bodies, it seems like these teenagers were killed almost immediately after capture, which is completely not the Hamas way of doing things. Hamas has always been a very patient organization in trying to make deals. So it shoots a hole in the Hamas theory, but from the Israeli perspective, I'm not sure that matters. It seems like launching revenge attacks is the sort of the driving momentum in the Israeli government right now. And, you know, the three people that they named as potential suspects, they've already destroyed one of them's house just on the idea that he might have had something to do with it. There's talk from some of the Deputy Defense Minister Dannon is saying, well, we should destroy every Hamas member's house now and destroy Hamas entirely. Defense Minister Yalon is saying, well, we should found a brand new settlement right in the middle of what would have been future Palestine in honor of these teens. So, I mean, the Israeli reaction, as usual, is spite.
Yeah. Well, now, so first of all, on the question of Hamas, does anybody have a theory, much less evidence, which, you know what, I don't know, circumstantial evidence or any kind of good reason that anyone has explained to believe that this was Hamas other than, you know, we don't like those guys here kind of thing?
Not at all. It fits into the Israeli narrative, and I think they sort of had their fingers crossed when it was a kidnapping that it was Hamas, because they could use that as a wedge to try to break up the unity government in Palestine. Mm-hmm. But the only group that ever claimed any credit for it was a group calling itself ISIS Palestine, which exactly how big they are or who they are, no one seems to know. Presumably some sort of offshoot of ISIS.
It was a political group that did this rather than just, I don't know, somebody who did it or two somebodies?
There really isn't. I mean, there's no good, at least not that Israel has released to the public, there's no good evidence of what happened at all. Israel claimed to know it was Hamas, but they never offered any evidence to that effect, and Hamas has denied it, which, once again, Hamas is not normally the kind of group that denies doing something that they actually did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, and of course, you know, by Israel, you mean mostly Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, and what he says, right? And he's pretty much made it clear that, whatever, he just believes it was Hamas. He never even tried to make an argument, right? Just
right.
He says so.
It would have been extremely convenient for them for it to have been Hamas.
How much presence does Hamas even have on the West Bank anyway?
Pretty minimal. I mean, they have a few...
I mean, they don't have troops there. They don't have... Or, I don't know. What do they have?
No, I mean, they have... There are a few activists that are still, you know, politicians and the like that are still in the West Bank from back before the split between Hamas and Fatah.
Right, but brigades of fighters on the West Bank?
No, certainly not.
Yeah. So, anyway. And then, so, all right, now, before they found the bodies, go ahead and describe a little bit more detail. Oh, well, we're almost at the break. God damn, time flies so fast. Well, and we got started late in the segment, too. That's what happened. But when we get back, I'd like to hear a little bit more of the narrative about the way the IDF has been acting in the West Bank, and for that matter, in the Gaza Strip, ever since they were abducted, since the boys turned up missing. And then, of course, the real bad news is all the bombing overnight, and for all I know, continuing right now. In so-called response, although, you know, just like in blaming Hamas, I think it's pretty clear they're just taking advantage of the opportunity to do what they want anyway, which is the same as always. But anyway, I've talked us all the way into the music now. Good. So we'll be right back on the Scott Horton Show with Jason Ditz, news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jason Ditz, news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. Here's a headline from the Jerusalem Post. Israeli jets pound Gaza, hit 34 targets in overnight strikes. Late last night, I was up late looking at Twitter. They're all kind of shock and awe type pictures coming in from the Gaza Strip. And I don't know if there, do you know, Jason, if there are reports of casualties yet?
Not that I've seen yet. No, I mean, certainly there have been casualties, but a lot of times that's pretty late to come out of the Gaza Strip.
Yeah. So, and now I guess, I'm sorry, rewind a little bit for us and talk about it seemed pretty crazy, it's pretty out of control, the kind of collective punishment and was it random searches or just door-to-door searches for the kidnapped teens over the last couple of weeks there on the West Bank?
In Ramallah? Pretty much that's what's been going on.
Just tell us as much about that as you can.
Because
to make up for my lack of coverage of this very important issue, please.
Well, since the teens went missing, Israel started conducting pretty aggressive military operations. They detained hundreds of people out of the nearby area of where the teens were thought to have gone missing, detaining people that just happened to be in the area. There's no evidence that any of them necessarily knew anything, but I guess they were just detaining people on the hope that one of them might have seen something and could be eventually roughed up to the point that they would talk. A lot of people were killed, at least six as of earlier in the week. I'm not sure how many, of course, now with more attacks in the Gaza Strip, although exactly the connection between the deaths of the teens and the Gaza Strip is pretty thin, because Israel was attacking Gaza pretty much daily anyway. There's no sign that there was any Gaza connection to what happened to the teenagers, Israel seems to be escalating the attacks nominally as part of the retaliation for the teenagers, but really Israel just sometimes gets into these little you know, few week spans where they've just decided to go all out and attack in Gaza, and you have Foreign Minister Lieberman talking about how Israel should conquer the Gaza Strip militarily and annex it, and so this is certainly not unprecedented for Israel. They do this sometimes, at least once or twice a year.
Yeah, I saw on Twitter last night some, I think, not necessarily critics, but just newsy people wondering, forgot who it was exactly, but some pretty mainstream, I think, wondering. I wonder if they're going to come out later with an explanation of any connection to the Rafah border crossing into Egypt, or whether not. They're just bombing it because they want to bomb it right now. I guess, I don't imagine they came out with a quote-unquote reason that they were bombing the Rafah border crossing or the area near it last night.
No, I wouldn't expect them to even offer any sort of explanation unless there's suddenly a complaint from a human rights group about a large number of civilians getting killed. That's really the only time you get a justification from Israel, and usually those justifications come after the fact. They change several times while they keep trying to come up with an excuse that'll stick.
Yeah. Which, you know, as long as they got American veto power on the UN, I guess it doesn't matter whether any of the criticism sticks or not.
Right. And there was a UN resolution last week that was criticizing Israel for its military operations in the West Bank related to searching for the teenagers, complaining about killing civilians in mass detentions. But it never came up to a vote because the U.S. made clear they would veto anything if it mentioned Israel by name.
Yeah. Certain Middle Eastern, Mediterranean states over there. Maybe give the longitude and latitude for Tel Aviv or something like that.
Right. You could say they made it sound like the U.S. would have been okay with a statement that deplored the deaths of the Palestinians so long as it didn't make any mention of the fact that it was Israeli troops that killed them.
Yeah. Man, and then, so, I don't know what all effect this has politically, other than, as you said earlier, in citing all these other examples, I know over at the Electronic Intifada, there are a huge roundup, really too big of a roundup of quotes, not just from people with power, but to random yahoos on Facebook and that kind of thing, but it sounds like what this serves to do more than anything is to move the entire foreign policy of the right-wing Israeli coalition further to the right. Now what was unacceptable to say 2 or 3 weeks ago is now acceptable to say, you know what, let's just go ahead and reconquer Gaza. Like they haven't conquered it all along. Right now let's go ahead and end all pretense of peace with the Palestinian Authority. Let's go ahead and that's what this is really about, right? Is this is their revenge for the unity government between Fatah and Hamas that was forged after the failure of the complete joke of the completely dishonest peace talks on the part of the Israelis toward the creation of some pseudo Palestinian state that they never meant to allow to exist in the first place.
Right, and they've been pretty clear that this Palestinian state's never going to happen. Even before the teenagers were found a couple of days ago, Prime Minister Netanyahu was making a speech about how Israel's going to have to keep the entire West Bank border with Jordan forever now because of ISIS. They're saying, well, ISIS is on Jordan's opposite border with Iraq.
Right.
Might conceivably take Jordan out. Which is pretty speculative.
I mean, just think about that. When George H.W. Bush said, stay out of the Gulf War because it'll ruin the whole coalition. It'll be too obvious, you know, your role in promoting this thing from your occupied territory in D.C. And same thing with Bush Jr. Like, some ally, we can't dare have them participate in our crappy foreign policy over there because it'll just explode everything. And just imagine if we actually have firefights on the ground with Israeli troops on the ground in Jordan fighting ISIS, you know, and what that'll do to all the different sides of this thing over there. Just holy crap.
And it could easily happen. That's the scary part. I mean,
and it's all getting worse over there anyway. I mean, everybody's just waiting for the other shoe to drop anyway. If the other shoe to drop is the Israelis getting in there, oh my God, there could be nukes going off. At that point, all bets are off, I think. I don't know. Pakistan's
right.
got nukes.
It's expanding everywhere. They're launching attacks in Lebanon. They're on the Jordanian border. They've taken large chunks of Syria and Iraq and formed this, what they're calling a caliphate, although their rivals don't see it as one.
Yeah, ISIS guys claiming the flag in the Sinai Peninsula too, right?
Right.
Yeah. It's not, man, I'm sorry we're out of time for this, Jason, because we're just getting into a very important subject there. But we'll talk again soon. Thank you very much for your time today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
It's Jason Ditz, everybody. The great Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Hey, Al Sky here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, on Liberty Radio Network from noon to 3 Eastern Time on the weekdays. Full archives at scotthorton.org. And our next guest on the show today is David Stockman. I was supposed to already have the book in my hand here for the bio. He's formerly a congressman, was a budget director in the Reagan administration, and worked on Wall Street for a while. And now he is a writer. Oh, he's the author of a book called The Triumph of Politics. And this one is The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. And he writes at DavidStockmansContraCorner.com. DavidStockmansContraCorner.com. Welcome to the show, David. How are you doing?
Very happy to be with you, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Thank you for joining us. I was going to get the book read and then interview you all about the book, but I got tired of procrastinating. I haven't gotten tired of procrastinating the book, but I got tired of procrastinating on getting you on the show. So I'm going to take the opportunity of your great World War I article here. Sarajevo is the fulcrum of modern history, the Great War and its terrible aftermath. And then there's also this other great article that I can't stop talking about on the show because it's... I think I could say if there was one single thing I would try to get every American to read, it would be this: the ultimate explanation of the connection between the central bank and the empire and what it costs the American people. It's called Keynesian Myths, Monetary Central Planning, and the Triumph of the Warfare State. It's the transcript of a speech that David Stockman gave at the Committee for the Republic in February. Okay, so I'll just ask you, we'll start with Sarajevo. Of course, it was Saturday was the anniversary of the assassination of the 100-year anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and which began the First World War. So I'll just let you take it from there.
Well, yes, it's the 100-year anniversary, and of course, the conventional historians would like us to believe that this is all ancient history, that it can be sequestered in a 4-year span of archival curiosities about battles, mustard gas, and monuments to the fallen. But in fact, it's the fulcrum of the entire history of the modern world. It had a huge, long footprint that has lasted for 100 years, and I say this occurred in 3 dimensions. One, it gave rise to a century of totalitarianism, statism, and war, World War II, the Korean War, the Cold War, all of the interventions and massive expansion of the American Empire that occurred in pursuit of that, and then continued into the immensely overdone and exaggerated war on terrorism. So that's the first dimension, and it is still with us. In fact, you can look at the chaos in the Middle East today, Syria, Iraq, the White House's proposal to intervene in situations that are none of our business, all originated in borders that were drawn in 1960. The second leg of this is that World War One destroyed the 50-year golden era of prosperity that the world had enjoyed owing to what I call the liberal international economic order. Free trade, free mobility of people and migration, free movement of capital, fiscal rectitude, governments balanced their budgets, and a gold standard that kept money sound and kept inflation and excessive speculation out of the system. All of that was destroyed by desperate governments during World War One, as they, exhausted themselves financially. They basically destroyed their currency, suspended the gold standard, borrowed themselves into massive amounts of debt. In England, for instance, their debt increased 14-fold. Eventually, when we got into the war, which we never should have been involved in, our debt went from $1 billion, where it had been for 50 years since Gettysburg, to $27 billion in really just a few months during our participation in World War One. Now, the reason this is important is that the old system, Humpty Dumpty, so to speak, was never put back together again once the Golden Age and its components were knocked off the wall. The next 100 years became a period of monetary central banking, the rise of fiat central banks, Keynesian economics, massive government intervention in capitalist free market economies, the enormous growth of the welfare state that is dragging down all of the economies of the developed world today. Finally, it is not often appropriately connected, but it should be, and that is the Great Depression, which was the traumatic domestic event of modern times, was simply the delayed aftermath or cost of World War One coming home to roost. And unfortunately, it was not properly understood. The historians today don't even acknowledge the connection. I have a long section in my book, and we can talk about it. But it is important because the Great Depression became the, it changed the intellectual tides to the conviction that capitalism was inherently flawed, inherently unstable, prone to drastic collapses and depressionary downward spirals, and therefore without activist government, constant intervention both fiscally and by the central bank, the capitalist economic system would fail. That's upside down. The failure was that the sound finances that existed before World War One were destroyed by the war. They were never recreated, and eventually the world economy collapsed in the 1930s. Capitalism got blamed when really it should have been blamed on borrowing, the collapse of the gold standard, the massive inflation of currencies that occurred during the war and its aftermath. So, in other words, we have had 100 years of aftermath that have given rise to all of the great problems that threaten free market capitalism and liberty and democratic government in the world in which we live today.
All right. Well, on that last point, what about the Great Depression of 1920 and 21? Because that usually is kind of shorthand in the Austrian school for even if the government, the central bank, inflates a giant bubble to pay for a war, if you just let it hit bottom and let all the bad debts liquidate and leave it alone and take a hands-off policy, things will get back going again. And I know Rothbard teaches in America's Great Depression that really prices should have been falling through the 20s because of all the increases in productivity, the so-called Roaring 20s, and that the price stability was actually disguising the real inflation of the money supply that whole time. But I guess so the question is, are you saying that the recovery from the Great Depression of 1920-21 was actually not a real recovery, but one of these, you know, another inflated bubble that disguised the real pain that was due from the cost of the war? Or was it the it was really the British and their refusal to come to terms with their war costs and America still propping them up, Strong and Norman and all of that?
Yeah, yeah. There are many of elements of what you say, so let's take it one piece at a time. The Great Depression, so-called, of 2021, actually, I agree, was proof that if we allow the marketplace to work its will and liquidate excesses and bubbles and wartime debts, that eventually those things get purged, and the economy then hits bottom and regenerates a healthy basis for growth. Now, that did happen to some degree in 1920-21. There was a tremendous war inflation that people forget about. The French currency quadrupled their inflation, or tripled during that time. British inflation doubled. American inflation doubled. But a lot of our commodity prices went up three or four-fold when we became the granary for the world and had a temporary booming artificial export market. So all of that had to be adjusted back to the pre-war status quo ante. Most of that happened, but unfortunately it wasn't sustained. And here's the second leg of this, and that is in 1923 the Fed discovered that it had the power, which was granted unfortunately to finance World War One. It had the power to intervene in the bond market and to essentially inflate the credit structure of the United States in an effort to try to help the British get back on the gold standard. Perhaps, you know, the intention of Benjamin Strong was good. The world would have been better off if the whole European world could have gotten back to the 1914 status quo ante. But unfortunately, the way he went about it was to suppress U.S. interest rates far below what they should have been in 1923 through 1929 in order to encourage capital to flow to Britain, which was unwilling to discipline itself financially and to really deal with the consequences of its war debts and its war finance. That, in turn, fueled tremendous speculative bubbles in real estate in the mid-20s in the United States, and then eventually the final blow-off in the stock market. Between 1924 and 1929, margin debt in the United States increased from about $1.5 billion to $9 billion, which sounds like small numbers today, but that was in the order of 1.5 to 2% of GDP, which would be far bigger than what the margin debt that we're facing, even as we have another bubble today. So, unfortunately, we had the impact of what of who I call Bubbles Ben 1.0, Benjamin Strong, who basically created the bubbles that took the economy from a healthy recovery that started in 1923. To the final boom and then bubble blow-off in 1929, one of the factors that paved the way for the Great Depression that followed in both its severity and length. The other thing it did was give rise to a massive international bond market. In effect, corporations were raising equity in this booming stock market. They used the cash to buy foreign bonds in order to generate yield and increase their earnings and, you know, sort of play the financial engineering game. The big bond market allowed foreigners to borrow the equivalent which of today, $1.5 trillion, which was used to buy American exports. Well, that helped the economy boom for a period of time, but it was all on borrowed money. Mm. It was vendor finance. We were essentially loaning the money to our customers to buy our exports. When the market collapsed in 1929, the foreign bond market collapsed. The bonds were the subprime of their day. They went to 7 cents on the dollar. And when foreign, when the foreign bond market dried up, demand for U.S. exports cratered overnight, dropped 80% from 29 to 1932. The collapse of the export industries then filtered back into the domestic economy, and a huge reduction in inventories and capital spending, and fueled the cycle that became the Great Depression. So all of this is, one, a carryover from World War One, and second, due to the bad central banking policies of the mid-1920s that tried to deal with you know, the hangover on the cheap, but instead of causing prosperity, they caused a financial boom, a bubble, and a bust that then saddled the world with this enormous misfortune that we call the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm. And now, so if I go back to my my junior high school social studies class, which is what I imagine, you know, is mostly I think what the consensus opinion in America is about this, is that back when there was too much freedom, you had these top hat wearing robber barons who owned everything. And then finally, after they blew up everything with their the wild excesses of their free market capitalism, finally, you know, great granddaddy Roosevelt came and brought them to heel for the benefit of the people of the country. And so that's why we have to have every regulation, actually, ever since then, is justified in that exact same way. This is the only way that people can protect themselves from business, is by hiring the government to regulate that business. And that really is, you know, certainly the foundational myth of the American state as it exists right now. But which is just amazing, since it's so wrong and has such terrible consequences, as you've described. But I wanted to ask you one I guess kind of minor point here before we get further into the Depression, which is that, you know, after the bubble broke in 29, if I read you right in one of these essays here, the Keynesian Myths essay, I think you're saying that the numbers all show that even despite Hoover's big government, progressive, liberal, Republican interventionism, by the time Roosevelt was sworn in, the correction had already set in, that the crash was so bad after 29 that... I think you say the beginning of the recovery had already begun. The Great Depression at that point was over until Roosevelt came and got it started again.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The Hoover recovery began in June 1932, 6 months before the election. You don't read that in the school books, because modern history is totally dominated by the liberal and Keynesian view of what happened during the 1930s, which, as we're discussing, is 180 degrees at variance with the true facts.
But now this recovery wasn't based on funny money, though, you're saying. This
was
real recovery.
No, I think it was based on the fact that finally, after the boom of the 20s, which was artificial and fueled by easy money at the Fed and massive speculation that it funded through margin loans, so-called call money market on Wall Street, that once that once that crash had been fully absorbed and excesses began to be liquidated, the economy actually hit bottom. Exports were down 80%. They finally hit bottom. Capital spending was down 85%. It finally reached the point where it was going to begin to rise. Inventories were massively liquidated because they were overinvested in during the boom. But you liquidate inventories one time, and after the liquidation is over, then businesses have to begin to rebuild. Now, my point is that that's where the U.S. economy was, despite some of the stupid things Hoover did. And obviously, signing Smoot-Hawley in June 1930 compounded and prolonged the problem. It was a very bad decision. Bringing in all of the business and labor leaders of the country in late or in 1930 and telling them, don't cut wages, don't cut prices, keep everything propped up, was a huge economic mistake, because the economy was crying out to liquidate the inflationary excesses that had been carried over from the war and from the Fed's artificial boom of the 1920s. So Hoover made mistakes, but despite those, the economy was coming up off the bottom. Between June and November, For instance, rail loadings increased 20%, construction orders were up by 25%, 1 million people were rehired, put back to work, which is a big number given the size of the labor force then. The stock market began to reflect that with a 40% gain over those 6 or 7 months. Wholesale prices, which had been deflating dramatically, 40 or 50% after the crash, began to recover. And so clearly the turnaround was there. There was no existential crisis of capitalism. Even the banking system was pretty well wrung out by that point. People, you don't see that in the history books either, but by October 1932, right before the election, the last of the insolvent banks had been closed. The rate at which deposits were being lost went down to a trickle. And essentially, the economy was ready to recover on its own sort of capitalist juices and dynamics. And it was only in the last month or so before Roosevelt's inauguration. Remember, it was delayed in those days, March 3rd, 1933, that the banking crisis was kindled. Not because the banks were insolvent or because the Fed hadn't printed enough money and bought enough bonds, as Bernanke and even Milton Friedman said, but because a small crisis in Michigan became a national crisis when Roosevelt refused to cooperate with Hoover. It could have been solved easily. And when his advisors announced that they were going to depart from sound monetary and fiscal policies and essentially unlink the dollar from gold after it had been linked for 100 years at a constant rate of 1/20th ounce of gold per dollar. Right. That caused a panic in the gold market. You don't even read that, and that panic occurred in the last 2 weeks of February. You don't read that anywhere in the history books, but the panic in the gold market, which was massive, the people were coming to the gold window, and in those days we still had a gold exchange standard to turn in their cash for gold. And it created a panic because in those days the currency, the dollar, had to be backed 40% by gold. And as the gold of the Treasury drained away, there was a fear that currency would be shrunk. And as a result of that, people went to the banks for currency through, in areas all over the country out of fear that the run on gold was going to upset the monetary system. But that run on gold ended once Roosevelt got in office, and essentially they reopened the banks within 3 weeks without doing anything. In other words, the so-called banking crisis is vastly overstated in the history books. It was not solved through regulation and reform. It was solved by allowing things to quiet down after the inauguration. In fact, Hoover's people were still in the Treasury, and they reopened 7 out of 9,000 banks in the weeks right after the inauguration on an as-is-where-is basis. So there's a tremendous amount of mythology about how capitalism was on its last leg, how the banking crisis brought the system down, how the Great Depression never would have ended, when all of that isn't true. The Great Depression was over. The banking crisis was a tempest in a teapot caused by Roosevelt on the eve of his inauguration. And the New Deal had nothing to do with resolving that crisis. In fact, the New Deal, and we can go into that at another time, prolonged the Hoover recovery that then reemerged after the inauguration period banking crisis had ended.
Right. All right, now, and I'm sorry because it's not a minor point. It's a huge point, but it takes a while to get there, but to get through. But I'm glad that I asked you because you know, that was certainly new to me, that it really was already, the clearing had already taken place by the time Roosevelt even showed up, which, of course, makes sense. It'd been, what, 2.5 years, right? So,
right. Yeah, and I think it's just important because that becomes another fulcrum point of history.
Right.
As you said in
huge.
Your question, it was all blamed on free markets, and I say the problem was free money. The Fed created too much free money. The Fed created too much speculation, both in real estate and out in the booming industrial areas like Pittsburgh and Detroit and Chicago and Akron and Youngstown and so forth, and ultimately on Wall Street, where just a rip-roaring casino got going on margin debt. And I can't really stress that enough. The margin debt right near the crash in October 1929 was $9 billion. The GDP was $90 billion at the time, so that's 10% of GDP. Put that in today's context, the GDP is $17 trillion. That'd be the equivalent of $1.7 trillion of margin debt. Now, today, even though we have all this froth in the market, and I think margin debt is out of control, it's only $450 billion. So if you put it in today's perspective in terms of size of the economy in dollars, mm-hmm. the margin debt was something like four times greater at the peak in 1929 than it is even today. So you can see the mischief that is caused by central banking that tries to take over the financial system, and it gave rise to the crash. And then the mythology that capitalism had failed, that free markets had failed, that capitalist buccaneers had caused the problem, when in effect it was speculation based on easy money coming from central banks that had way overstepped their bounds.
Right. All right. Now, I should have known that there's no way in the world we're going to be able to do this in one interview at all. But I'm really glad, though, that we got into detail rather than being too overbroad. But I would like to talk with you about, the boom and the bust, the boom being the bombs and the bust being the end of each inflationary bubble that seems to come with each and every war. Unless I'm making some kind of error and I'm extrapolating some causation where it's only a correlation, but we're way over time and I gotta let you go, and I gotta get you back on the show to ask you all about that, maybe later this week or next week, sir. That'd be all right.
Yeah, let's shoot for next week if we could do that. Be happy to.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for your time on the show. It's been great.
Great, thank you.
All right, everybody, that is David Stockman. He is the author, of course, of the book The Great Deformation, of course, caused by the central bank and the government intervention in the free economy. And now check out these articles here. Let me talk about these articles. Both of these are just really, you know, something else. You really got to look at them, okay? Sarajevo is the fulcrum of modern history, the Great War and its terrible aftermath, and Keynesian myths, monetary central planning, and the triumph of the warfare state. This one, it's like the speech I gave about how everything is Wilson's fault and the speech I gave about how all wars are connected to the boom and bust cycle, only combined and then 1,000 times better by someone who's a real expert, who's the kind of person who I'm just cribbing. Keynesian myths, monetary central planning, and the triumph of the warfare state, the ultimate essay on the connection between central banking and war and the boom and the bust cycle. So please go and look at that. It's at davidstockmanscontracorner.com. davidstockmanscontracorner.com. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for wallstreetwindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at wallstreetwindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. So that was cool. That was David Stockman. And I kept him through the break, and then I kept him a little over the top of the hour there, and then finally had to go, man. But I'm going to have him back on the show. I'm going to read that book, too. One of these times, I'm going to take a month off when I win the lottery or something and catch up on my book reading. I swear. Anyway, that whole thing will be at scotthorton.org soon. Next up today is our good friend Gareth Porter, the Martha Gellhorn Award-winning journalist for Interpress Service and TruthOut.org and author of the book Manufactured Crisis, The Truth About the Iran Nuclear Scare, and good friend of mine and the show. Welcome back, Gareth. How the hell are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for doing the journalism that you do and showing up on the show to talk about it, too. I appreciate
Glad
it.
Glad to be back.
All right. U.S. demand for deep centrifuge cut is a diplomatic ploy. Now, I guess I should... I don't do this often enough. I should preface this conversation with, hey, everybody, listen up. This is really important, even though it sounds boring and technical. This is about one of the most important issues in the whole wide world. Not that it's a real issue. It's a manufactured crisis. However, there is work being done right now to put this manufactured crisis behind us, and whether that can be accomplished or not is hugemongous. So it's really important. So now we're going to listen to Gareth Porter explain about U.S. demand for deep centrifuge cut is a diplomatic ploy. Please do.
Well, you know, the first point I want to make is that this article represents a certainly a partial change of interpretation on my part of what is happening in the talks. I mean, I certainly began the last few weeks with the assumption that the Obama administration was serious about the idea that it had to have a lengthening of the so-called breakout period, meaning the time that it would take Iran to enrich enough uranium at low levels so that they could, to enrich enough uranium at weapons grade levels so that they could build one bomb. That's the concept of breakout timeline. So I assumed that it was true that the Obama administration was demanding a lengthening of that timeline from the current supposed 2 to 3 months to something more like 6 to 12 months, because this is what Secretary of State John Kerry said back in April when he was testifying before Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And there are other leaks, there was an article by Robert Einhorn, or more than one piece by Robert Einhorn, which made the same point. And the point of all this was supposedly that the Iranians are going to have to accept a deep cut in the number of their centrifuges because that would be necessary in order to lengthen that timeline. Now it turns out, as I document in this latest story, that it's not really necessary for the Obama administration to demand such cuts. It's not necessary for Iran to agree to such deep cuts in the number of centrifuges in order to get the timeline to somewhere between 6 and 12 months. Because, in fact, the administration and Iran could agree on arrangements that would ensure that the timeline would be increased to somewhere between 6 and 12 months without really cutting the number of centrifuges that Iran is actually operating right now.
And that's what we talked about that you learned in your interview with the Iranian foreign minister, was that they're willing to oxidize all of their enriched uranium gas to therefore make it impossible to enrich further, or at least
That's true at one level. There are two different levels here that one has to take into account. One level is that you're right. The Iranians have put on the table a proposal that would say we will make sure that there is no buildup of a low enriched uranium UF6 stockpile that could then be used for higher level weapons grade enrichment, and that proposal would indeed have the effect of making it possible for Iran to maintain a higher number of centrifuges. But beyond that, we now know that that the calculations that would have been available to Secretary of State John Kerry and the Obama administration when they were making decisions on these negotiations would show that, all they had to do was to reduce the stockpile to a level of like 1,000 kilograms so that there would be no possibility of a breakout in less than about 6 to 12 months. So they knew well ahead of time, quite apart from the Iranian proposal, they knew that all they had to do was reduce the stockpile over time to close to zero or even to 1,000, and they would get the breakout timeline that they were supposedly so concerned about. Right. And so that's the new element in this story, that, in fact, the administration knew quite apart from the Iranian proposal that it was not necessary to demand these cuts. There was a way to do it simply by reducing the stockpile. And that could be done, you know, in various ways. The Iranian proposal certainly offers one way to do it, but, you know, all they had to do was to negotiate with the Iranians. We'll reduce the stockpile. You can keep the roughly 10,000 centrifuges that you're already using, and the ones that you haven't used, and as I point out, the Iranians have had about 9,000 or so centrifuges that they either installed or put in place in Fordo or Natanz, but have not used. They've simply not actually enriched any uranium at all in those with those centrifuges. And so clearly what was going on here was that these were part of a negotiating stance on the part of the Iranians. The Iranians were hoping to trade them off for presumably being able to keep the 10,000 centrifuges that they were in fact using. And so that's the kind of deal that would really be feasible if the United States were simply interested in a breakout timeline of 6 to 12 months.
Right. Okay, well, so here's the thing. I mean, obviously they're dishonest and everything, but is it clear exactly what the ploy is, whether they have to have something to keep arguing about up till January 20th and maybe a little bit beyond for the politics of things, or is this a ploy to sabotage the damn deal?
Well, my guess is, we don't know the answer to that for sure, but my guess is, from the total context of the negotiations, that what the administration is aiming for is to use their demand for the reduction, a steep reduction in centrifuges. And by the way, you know, apparently there was some mention in the draft that was submitted by the P5 Plus One of as few as 500. In other words, it appears that the French were allowed to insert their demand for, you know, as little as 500 centrifuges to remain as part of the deal. That was part of the proposal that was submitted by the P5 Plus One in June. So, I mean, you know, I don't think that was the only. I think there was another figure of somewhere between 2,000 and 5,000. But in any case, you know, the point is that I think that the United States is really using the threat of you know, maintaining that position as a ploy to get the Iranians to give up or to significantly alter the insistence that they must have the right to support the Bushehr reactor with their own indigenous enrichment capability, and even future indigenous reactors when and if the such reactors come online. And this, of course, would be you know, much larger number of centrifuges that would be required. So that's what I think the administration is really aiming for, and they're willing to give up this demand in return for concessions on the longer-term part of the deal.
All right. Hang tight. More with Gareth Porter in just a sec, y'all. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm talking with Gareth Porter, from Interpress Service, IPSnews.net, author of the book Manufactured Crisis, where he completely and totally, seriously, completely and totally debunks all the hype about Iran's so-called quest for nuclear weapons that never did exist. Manufactured Crisis. And anyway, so this article is called U.S. Demand for Deep Centrifuge Cut is a Diplomatic Ploy. And the point being, they don't need to cut down their number of centrifuges that they have so much as they need to use the uranium they've enriched, go ahead and convert it to fuel rods and start putting it to use and reduce the amount of the stockpile down to make it where it's the same difference. If the question is, how long would it take them to have enough 90% uranium to make a nuke? And that would be supposedly a year is what's tolerable. And you're saying they could have it either way, and they've acknowledged that they could have it either way. And so their insistence on the destruction of all of these extra centrifuges, you're saying, is really a sticking point that the Americans are sticking to unnecessarily, and they know it.
Yeah,
and they don't have to. They can back
my
off
favorite,
right now on this.
My favorite paragraphs in this piece, Scott, which I'd love to have a chance to mention, is the great irony that David Albright and Ali Heinonen, co-authoring a piece dated June 3rd, warn, you know, they're terribly eager to warn the American people against any deal that would trade off reducing the level of centrifuges in return for reducing the level of the stockpile of low enriched uranium. But in the process of doing that, they actually admit precisely the case that I'm making in my piece, which
right.
is that even if if the stockpile were reduced to zero, they would have well over a year. But even if it were reduced to if it remained at 10,000, that would be 6 months. And if it were reduced to 1,000 kilograms, it would be closer to a year. So I'm sorry, I think I got it mixed up there. So 1,000 would be 6 months, and zero would be closer to a year. So that's what they have admitted in their piece, warning against precisely this kind of a deal. I thought that was a great irony.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, and they'll get away with it too, except where you're concerned and me here. all right, and now, so, well, let me ask you this about the politics of it. And I know that's not exactly what you're focusing here on, you know, what they say in D.C., but are you qualified to answer? Do you think that is the proverbial Council on Foreign Relations still behind this thing or not? I mean, is the American foreign policy establishment, are they nodding at each other and saying, all right, we should go ahead and go through with this nuclear thing? Or is it really just another screw job like 2005?
Well, I don't think that there's a complete consensus by any means, but I think that that most of the Council on Foreign Relations people are saying, yeah, we can have a deal here. To some extent, you know, I think they don't understand what's really going on at a technical level in the talks.
Well, is the deal an end in itself, or are they like me saying we could get this issue out of the way so we could have a little bit maybe more normal relations with Iran in the future, even in the long term?
I think it's both a desire for some calm in the relationship, and it's also a matter of recognizing that if they don't get a deal, that the cost and risk are going to be high. I mean, in other words, this is not a costless option at all. So I think, you know, this revelation that, in fact, when Kerry said we're going to demand an increase in the breakout timeline from 6 to 12 months, he was really opening up the way for a deal that would allow the Iranians to have 10,000 centrifuges. That puts an entirely new light on it, and I think that means that they do, in fact, want to have a deal, even though we're not out of the woods yet. I mean, you know, I think that it remains to be seen whether they can work out a deal on the on the longer term, the long-term settlement, which is what are the Iranians going to be allowed to do 6 or 7 years from now or 15 years from now? But, you know, as Frank von Hippel, the former White House senior person on science and technology, said when he was briefing people in Washington, D.C. last week, he said, you know, if we put off the decision on whether Iran can have 50,000 or 100,000 more centrifuges for several years, you know, the situation is going to look very different. And I think that's precisely right. Mm-hmm. So all they have to do is say this is a two-stage agreement, and that will, I think, take care of it. Now, that doesn't, of course, deal with the problem of the pro-Israel lobby in Washington. They're going to howl and scream and make this look like the worst sort of sellout since Yalta, right? I mean, we can count on that. But I now have a different feeling for the way in which the administration is going to be balancing these things off, now that I understand what that Kerry remark was all about.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I would just feel better about it if Obama and Kerry were adverse to failure, but since that seems to be their specialty.
If they had a better record, we would all feel more secure, that's for sure.
Yeah, but, you know, again, you know, the bottom line of this is that it's a manufactured crisis. All their nuclear facilities are capital S safeguarded facilities, and all their uranium is accounted for and always has been. So this really only is, to me, a matter of dotting I's, crossing T's, shaking hands, and quit being such a jerk, everybody, and let's get along.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. And I would just add two more talking points, Scott. One, as you say, the facilities, the nuclear facilities are all safeguarded. What the Iranians are prepared to do is to go beyond that and say, yeah, you can you can come and visit all of our places where we work on centrifuges, which are not part of the regular safeguard agreement, but you know that goes beyond
the UN resolution demands too, which is good.
Right. So so they're willing to go well beyond that in terms of openness to verification and surveillance by the IAEA. And the second point, maybe the three points that I have. The second point is that Iran is not going to clearly, you know, regardless of what the breakout time is, they're not going to declare to the world, okay, here we go now, we're kicking out the IAEA, we're going to pay no attention to them, we're just going to start taking the low-enriched uranium out of the safeguarded facilities and take it into some secret place where we will start to enrich to weapons grade levels. It's the stupidest thing imaginable, and it has been called stupid by both people who are more reasonable, like Jim Walsh at MIT, and people who I think that are not so reasonable, like Gary Seymour, who was who's an extremist in his view of Iran, and his view of Iran is extremely paranoid.
Well, and at the same time, though, I mean, they're no more likely to create a secret program because how in the hell could they get away with it? If all the nuclear material is safeguarded, how are they going to divert it without the IAEA being able to say, hey, we can no longer verify the non-diversion of declared nuclear material here?
This whole idea that there's a secret sneak out, as Seymour puts it, is complete baloney. I mean, you know, it's just not feasible. The U.S. intelligence community does not really take it seriously. And it's part of a position that is much closer to the Israeli position. Of course, that's what David Albright always talks about. It's always
It goes to the title of your book and the whole point here, which is that this is a manufactured crisis. That whenever they're really talking about an Iranian nuclear weapons program, it's only innuendo. They don't really have a narrative where, yeah, they're going to go ahead and kick the inspectors out like North Korea and do it in front of everybody kind of thing, because they know they'll get bombed off the face of the earth before they'd be able to put a single one of them together. And then, on the other hand, they're not going to be able to sneak out, like you're saying, without getting caught anyway. And so,
Scott, I would go even further than what you've just said. I mean, I don't totally disagree with what you said, but I think I would go further by saying that even if The Iranians did not believe the military option was credible. And I think it's possible that they don't believe it's credible. I think it's quite possible. I don't think that that would change their calculus at all, because what the Iranians, particularly under the Rouhani administration, really want is to integrate their economy with the global capitalist economy. I mean, that's always been the Rafsanjani faction's its aim from the time Rafsanjani became president in 1989. And the first thing he did was, of course, to name Hassan Rouhani as his the secretary of the National Security Council, Supreme National Security Council.
To cut a nuclear deal with the Americans.
Well, that was what came later. But Hassan Rouhani was given the portfolio of dealing with the nuclear issue in 2003 under Khatami after he replaced Rafsanjani. But the point is that was still in line with the whole thrust of that faction's policy, which is to reach an accommodation with the United States and with the West. And the United States, of course, wasn't interested in that under Clinton or Bush. And Obama continued that policy of the Bush administration in many ways, although not completely. So that's really the fundamental fact that I think we should be understanding, and it's not part of the political discussion of Iran at all. That's simply been ignored, that fundamental fact.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm sorry that we're so far over time, because I wanted to ask you about what you think what's going on in Iraq will have to do, or what effect that'll have on the current Iran nuclear negotiations, help or hurt, or that kind of thing.
Well, I think it's going to help for sure. I mean, absolutely. There's no question about the fact that the U.S. and Iran have interests that are much more closely aligned now on Iraq. It's absolutely.
It's not a danger that that'll be too obvious, and so they'll have to sabotage one thing to do the other, or something stupid like that. You know, Democrats.
You mean that there's a political problem in
right.
Recognizing that.
Yeah, well, like, okay, look, we got to fight with Iran and Iraq, but at least we're going to blow up the nuclear deal.
Well,
I'm trying to think like a Democrat
here.
They
do have a political problem in taking that position, but that is the logic of the situation, and that's why I say over the next 6 or 7 years that there's certainly, unless a weird sort of right-wing Republican takes office, in which case all bets are certainly in question, if not off. I think we can say that the logic of the situation is leading towards an easing of tension, at the very least, between the U.S. and Iran.
Right. All right. I'm sorry. I'm so over time. I got to go right now. Bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
That's the great Gareth Porter, everybody. Oh, crap. The music's already playing. Oh, no. Here, I gotta find something to play for you. Take up some time here. Man, I really blew it on that one. I tried to interrupt him and say I had to go, but no. Let's see how long this is. This is Paul Montgomery talking about bombing Japan.
Between them. I was 21 years old, and I really was wanting to get the war over, and I wanted to get home. And if they told me to go bomb some cities, I went and bombed cities. They were bombed to nothing left except steps and chimneys. Complete 100% obliteration. It's not like going out and stick a bayonet in somebody's belly, okay? You still kill them, but you kill them from a distance, and it doesn't have that demoralizing effect upon you.
All right, y'all. Sorry about that. I'm bad on the clock today. Boy, am I bad at... I'm bad at doing radio. But I got a good taste in guests, so you got to let me off the hook. My clock ain't set to the radio clock. Hey, check out this great article. It's in the Washington Examiner. It's called First Gulf War in 1991 was America's opening... Iraq mistake. Well, that might be letting them off the hook a little bit there, but it's Gene Healy from the Cato Institute. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Gene?
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Very happy to have you here. So, take us back. Summer 1990, and, there are a lot of people who listen to the show, I think, who are quite young, or maybe they weren't paying attention at the time and really don't really know what happened other than America bombed Iraq back then. So maybe take us through how all this came about, if you could.
Well, in August of 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And for the rest of the year, you had an effort by George H.W. Bush to build a coalition to repulse Saddam. There was and get approval at the Security Council, and he did that. He actually and he went to Congress against the advice of the then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney. To get a resolution for authorizing the use of force, and January 15th, 1991 was Operation Desert Storm. And this is, you know, in history, because, you know, we won a quick battlefield victory and because the first Bush administration decided it wouldn't be prudent to go on and continue to Baghdad and occupy Iraq, history has looked on the first Gulf War pretty positively. I mean, people tend to remember things like Stormin Norman Schwarzkopf, the Scud Stud, you know, Arthur Kent from CNN, and the last ticker tape parade for victorious soldiers in Manhattan. But I think it's incumbent on us to look at the unintended consequences of this war. And even though it was a famous victory, even though the battlefield victory was swift, it deepened our entanglement in Iraq. It led to years of periodic bombings, no-fly zones, and punitive air raids against Iraq, along with a crippling set of sanctions. And these not only deepened our entanglement, but became the major planks in al-Qaeda's declaration of war against the United States. And it's been described as the 20 years war with Iraq. It's going on a quarter century now. And I think it's important, as you know, we're told by the neocons that we shouldn't relitigate the Iraq war. It seems to me we should go back and relitigate the Gulf War a bit and dispel this myth that a swift battlefield victory means that the going in the first place was a smart idea and led to positive results. It seems to me that the unintended consequences of that war are things we're still dealing with today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think this is why when Ron Paul got in that fight with Rudy Giuliani in the debate in 2007, why people just across the country just rallied to the fact that he was telling the honest truth. And I think for most people, they kind of knew it back in their head somewhere, but they never heard anyone say it in English out loud before, and certainly not a Republican politician. Just go ahead and be straight and say, hey, look, we'd been bombing them for 10 years straight over there before 9/11. And people just, they knew that was true. I mean, come on. You don't have to pay attention to politics to know that there was a giant war in 1991 over there and that, you know, that there'd been some kind of foreign policy since then, even if they didn't pay close attention to the sanctions and the no-fly zones. They knew that Clinton wasn't, you know, completely at peace over there or whatever. And so they just, you know, they rallied to the truth of that. Not that he was saying it was America's fault or that they wanted to blame themselves or whatever, any of that weird stuff, like in the accusation by Giuliani, for example. But just saying, yeah, like, hey, let's be honest about this. Our government got us into this mess. They went over there and poked a hornet's nest. As you said, part of it was how do you start a war right over Kuwait? So they had to build up Saddam Hussein into being the new Hitler. But then if this guy's Hitler, how are we going to come to the table with him ever? Even after we defeated him, there's still no coming to the table with him. You know, he's a mad dog, so damn insane, and all this propaganda. And so it was that easy to just keep up the containment policy and just keep the sanctions and the blockade on. And definitely, as Madeleine Albright said, that we'll never lift the sanctions until Saddam is gone. That's it. Regime changes the policy. They could never go back after that.
Even right. And look at our policy now. We're going to, you know, the war was sold by George H.W. Bush because it wasn't an inspiring goal to say, let's restore the Emir of Kuwait and protect the Saudi royal family. George H.W. Bush sold the war as it will lead to a new order for the ages. It'll end the threat of terror and make peace and justice possible. Well, look at our policy now. We've gone through 20 plus years of weakening Iran's major regional enemy, and our plan now is, with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria dominating northern Iraq, we're going to aid the moderates in Syria, wherever they are, and they're fighting Assad, who's also fighting ISIS. But on the other side, we're going to aid the Maliki government, and we're kind of going to try to do that in such a way that it doesn't unduly empower Iran. It's like there's a civil war in the Middle East, and we want to be on every possible side of it. It's something, I think, that makes restraint look a lot better by comparison.
Right. I got to tell you, I'm a little bit afraid that they're going to get their story straight, and that is that the Islamic State is the threat. Never mind Assad. At least that would be a consistent, and you could state that in one sentence. These guys are the bad guys, without a bunch of caveats about being on all other sides. But I think if they ever got their act together there, it would just mean a new, worse war. I'm sort of glad that they're so divided in which all sides they're backing, as crazy as that sounds right now.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that you're seeing this line for, we don't want to relitigate the Iraq war. We don't want to look back. That's not the issue right now. The issue is what to do now. But I think it's important, learn a little history to avoid rushing into making the same mistakes. And we've got the same characters who were responsible for the Iraq war, and in some cases, as in the case of Dick Cheney, were responsible for the original Gulf War, telling us, we can go back 3 years to when Obama, failed to get a status of forces agreement and didn't leave a residual force in Iraq. But that's as far as we can go. We can't look at whether our 20-plus year entanglement in Iraq was a good idea in the first place. I think it's pretty clear, although it's not a popular view, I think it's pretty clear it wasn't a good idea.
We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gene Healy from the Cato Institute about the first Gulf War, Operation Yellow Ribbon. Operation Vietnam never happened. You love war. Come on. Boom. Yeah. USA. First Gulf War in 1991 was America's opening Iraq mistake. And it's a really great article, and you make a lot of great points in it, and some of them are about how we got lied into that thing in the process back then in 1990-91. Can you take us through a bit of that?
Sure. Dick Cheney's Pentagon, Cheney remembers the Secretary of Defense in the first Gulf War. Now, one of the ways that the first Bush administration sold the Gulf War was by saying that it wasn't just about Kuwait, that Saddam Hussein was poised to roll across the Saudi border, take Saudi Arabia, and then control something like 40% of the world's oil reserves. And the Pentagon at the time claimed to have satellite photographs showing 1,500 tanks and 250,000 troops, Iraqi troops, massed on the Saudi border. There's a journalist named Gene Heller from the St. Petersburg Times at the time who decided to check. And this was around the time when you're first able to buy commercial satellite photographs. She got a couple of photographs of the border area in question, had them analyzed by former military intel people, and it didn't take a lot of analysis because the photographs showed empty desert in the area the Cheney's Pentagon said troops and tanks were amassing. And before she printed it, she contacted the Cheney's office three times, offering to spike the story if they could show her that she was wrong. And the response she got essentially was, trust us. And this is something that I think was lost in the aftermath of a pretty spectacular victory. But it appears she said years later in the Christian Science Monitor that it was, quote, a pretty serious fib, which I think is putting it lightly. So you had...
Well, I believe they told the king of Saudi Arabia the very same thing.
Yeah, you had what certainly looks like misinformation being propagated at the highest levels. You also had, there's no doubt that the Iraqi army was quite brutal in what they did in Kuwait, but there were stories, along the lines of the World War One propaganda about bayoneting Belgian babies. There was a story.
Let me go ahead. I have the clip right here. Let me play. It's real short.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
Okay, sorry, I couldn't resist. That's the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador. Lying.
Right. We found out about a year later. That was, I guess no one checked at the time. She wasn't in Kuwait. This is the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador. It was a complete PR campaign. And there are a number of congressmen who said that was instrumental in their vote for the authorization of the use of force, this idea that the Iraqi soldiers were ripping babies out of incubators. So as you've seen in a lot of other wars, you had a lot of misinformation going around. There wasn't evidence that Saddam Hussein was poised to take Saudi Arabia. And if he did, I cite some calculations in some of the Cato published at the time by a former Reagan's former top energy economist, David Henderson, who said that the oil weapon is a dud, that you're talking in the worst case scenario with Saddam Hussein taking Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, in addition to keeping Kuwait, that you're talking about something like, at worst, 24 cents a gallon more in gasoline, which, to my mind, is a pretty lousy reason to start a war and kill thousands of people.
Now, I knew that David Henderson was absolutely great on that issue, but I had no idea that he was great on that issue in the Bush government at the time, Gene. Holy.
Well, I think he was actually, he wasn't in the government at the time.
Oh, he'd been in the Reagan government. I'm sorry.
He had been Reagan's top energy economist at the Council of Economic Advisors. So
yeah, in other words, he was given this advice where they could hear it. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, very important.
So, it was a strange thing because at the time, while Bush 41 is talking about a new world order and eternal peace, at the same time, then Secretary of State James Baker is saying, if you want one word for why we need to fight this war, it's jobs. Well, Henderson's calculations showed that's a pretty lousy rationale for this kind of war, especially a war that ended up entangling us into, for the next 10 years, into low-level managerial bombings and punitive air raids. This really deepened an entanglement that caused a lot of hostility, and we're still paying the price for that.
Yeah. Well, and of course, there are the brutal war crimes quite deliberately in Desert Storm. They bombed the electricity and the waterworks and the civilian infrastructure of the country, and then they kept all the sanctions on. And I guess people debate the numbers, but not by very much, I don't think. It's pretty much settled that, high hundreds of thousands, almost a million people died from the decrease in their standard of living. When you compare the excess deaths and all that, as they do under the blockade and the no-fly zone bombings of the 1990s,
when you take, you know, the era before the war and compare it to the era of the blockade. And half
it's
of
certainly
them,
something that, yeah, I have seen very different numbers on the cost of the sanctions. You're absolutely right that the some of the bombing was designed for the post-war era, targeted at Iraq's infrastructure and industry to weaken Iraq and keep it containable. And it's certainly true that Paul Wolfowitz, who I'm not usually given to citing on anything, he said in 2003 that the nearly weekly bombings, the perception that the sanctions are killing Iraqi children in large numbers, and the presence of U.S. troops on Saudi soil, these are the Osama bin Laden's principal recruiting device. So the idea that that you look at this war and you look at January, February of 1991 and how quickly it was won, and you compare it to the prolonged occupation of Bush 43 and the cost that entailed, the idea that you make that comparison and you decide that the Gulf War was the good war, I don't think is tallying up all the costs for the United States and for Iraq. Mm-hmm. Well, in a large part, we are where we are now because of that decision to intervene in 1991.
Right. Well, and I think people like John Kerry and Bill Clinton and Joe Biden, had never lived down their opposition to the first Gulf War. Oh, how could you have opposed the greatest war ever? Why do you hate America so much? So then when it came to the second Gulf War, it was so obvious that Kerry was making that political calculation in 2002. I'm not making that political mistake again of saying no.
Absolutely. And not just Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, right. Basically every prominent Democrat at the time looked back on, because the authorization for the use of force in the Gulf War was a much, much closer vote than the one in 2002 for the Iraq War. And most of the Democratic leadership, Daschle, Gephardt, on and on, made exactly that calculation, that we're not going to be on the wrong side of this one. That calculation didn't work out so well. I mean, there's a good argument that the fact that Barack Obama wasn't in the Senate at the time and did make a speech about how he was against dumb wars helped him in the Democratic primaries, may have helped him put away Hillary Clinton. H.W. said at the end, right around the time of the ceasefire, he was exuberant. He said, by God, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all. And, the result of that, in many ways, is more Vietnams.
That's exactly right. Two of them, at least. Well, maybe three. Thanks very much, Gene.
Yeah, thank you.
I sure appreciate it. Everybody, that's Gene Healy. He's at the Cato Institute. He's the author of this book, The Cult of the Presidency. I should have mentioned that at the beginning. And he's the author of this article, First Gulf War in 91 Was America's Opening Mistake, at the Washington Examiner. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.